please join me in welcoming Fran Ulmer.
Thank you all for coming tonight to talk about the Arctic. We live in Alaska, so we care about it. But what I want to talk to you about tonight is why everybody should care about the Arctic. So my plan is, first we'll talk a little bit about what's changing, and then we'll talk about how that change is really impacting people who live in the Arctic and then outside the Arctic. And then let's explore this question of the geopolitics of the region, how this region, which is characterized both by competition. You can't hear me. Is that correct? Really? You can't hear me? Okay, you're good. All right, terrific. We'll talk about how this region geopolitically is becoming much more interesting to the world and why that is. So that's the plan for this evening. You know, I brought along that little quiz to try to make tonight a little more fun. Anybody have fun doing the quiz? Yes, okay. All right, so the other thing we'll do at the end of my remarks, we'll go through the true-false answers, and you can grade your own papers and see how well you did. So let's see if this is going to work. Oh, no. Really? Okay, let's see. Okay, this means I have to actually use the computer. All right, that means I'm going to have to stand here, which I regret. But at any rate, we'll do this. So I have good news for you. This will not happen in your lifetime. I hope. But if you look at how much change has already happened in our lifetimes, it's really pretty stunning how much sea ice loss we have experienced. This is just a picture from the front of the Healy, one of the US icebreakers, comparing 2007 and 2012. You get a sense, I don't know if you can actually see it, but you can probably see the ice. Yeah, great. Thank you for trying to fix it. You can probably see how much less ice there is. 50% less sea ice. Perfect. All right, we'll try that again. And if you compare these 2 years just as an example, you really get a feel for the dramatic loss of sea ice. And of course, it's not just in terms of extent, it's also in terms of volume. So about 50% less in extent and about 75% less in volume. In other words, we're losing multi-year ice. Now, most of you have probably heard a lot about this already, but what is stunning to me is how different, if you think about it in hundreds of years versus just the last 30 years, we are in an entirely different regime. And it's not just the summertime when there's the least amount of ice, it's also in the wintertime, which we experienced last year pretty dramatically in the Bering Sea. Unfortunately, there are many, many animals that need that ice, ice-dependent species that have evolved over a very long period of time that are reliant on that sea ice. So yes, you know about polar bears, but also walrus and ring seals and Arctic cod and many, many others. This is a picture you've probably seen before of the 30,000 walrus that were hauled out because there was no ice for them to rest on and use as a feeding platform. In addition to less sea ice, of course, there are much warmer temperatures. And we've experienced that for at least the last 20 or 30 years. But what's happening here is really completely out of bounds with what's happening globally. More than 2.5 times as warm as what is happening globally. We're losing glaciers. About 95% of all of the glaciers in the Arctic are in retreat. And of course, the Greenland ice sheet is a tremendous concern because not only is it melting, but the rate of melt is accelerating and it is contributing to sea level dramatically. And then there is permafrost. This kind of surprises most people that about a quarter of the northern hemisphere is underlain with permafrost. And that permafrost is showing signs of thawing in many of the places where we've measured it, which of course leads to a very unstable situation in terms of coastlines and for infrastructure, but also it has some serious implications in terms of additional global warming because of the release of methane. So let's see, going backwards. There we go. So ocean chemistry. I'm sure you've all heard about ocean acidification. The problem is that in the Arctic, because the water is cold, it absorbs even more CO2. So here, more than in many other places, we are already beginning to experience ocean acidification that has a tremendous impact on many, many species that rely on a certain stable balance of chemistry of the ocean. So what difference does that make for the people of the Arctic? Obviously, there are many, many answers to that question. It depends upon where you live and who you are. But for the indigenous people of the North particularly, who have relied upon many of those same species that are ice dependent, that are no longer safely relying on that sea ice, it has a big implication in terms of subsistence foods and culture. And it also has a, let's see, Lisa to the rescue. I'll just keep talking. So for the people of the Arctic, there are two main impacts that we see on a regular basis. One is the subsistence and the fact that food insecurity is caused by less sea ice and all of the creatures that rely on it. And secondly, a pretty dramatic change in terms of coastal communities that are experiencing so much more coastal erosion. So between permafrost thawing, which destabilizes infrastructure, thank you so much, I appreciate your help. The culture, the subsistence, food security, the safety, all of those things are incredibly important to the people of the North, as are, of course, the damages that are being experienced in the villages because of thawing permafrost and coastal erosion. A recent report from the University of Alaska pointed out how much that's likely to cost the state of Alaska. We're talking about big numbers, not just for the village communities that are experiencing the coastal erosion and the need to move, but also for urban infrastructure, for the pipeline, which of course was constructed with certain assumptions about whether or not the permanent permafrost would stay stable, not so much anymore. And then there's the impact of ocean acidification on our fishing communities, which is another study that the University of Alaska did, looking at which communities were actually likely to get the most negative impact associated with damage to fisheries because of ocean acidification. So what about people beyond the Arctic? People who have never even been to the Arctic, people who aren't even sure what the Arctic's all about. There are a lot of ways in which less ice in the Arctic and a warmer Arctic is impacting them, whether they know it or not. And here are just a few examples of what difference it really makes, regardless of where you live, that there's a lot less ice and a warmer Arctic. So in a way, you could think of the Arctic as the planet's air conditioner. It helps stabilize climate in a variety of ways. But if you just think about all of that sea ice that used to exist, that is to say when the ice was a white blanket on the top of our planet, reflecting and sending back some of that solar energy, now that dark water and dark land where there's less snow, less ice, is absorbing that energy, adding to the heat of not only the Arctic, but to the planet. And as we are seeing, in addition to that effect, we are seeing is destabilization of the jet stream. So a warmer Arctic means that there is less of a temperature differential between the Arctic and mid-latitudes. And Jennifer Francis and other atmospheric scientists would be the first to tell you that the science is not fully understood on exactly how this is working. However, it is increasingly clear that a warmer Arctic is leading to this phenomenon. You've been reading about the polar vortex in the lower 48, right? So what is happening is a lot of the cold air that should be up here is going south, and a lot of the warmer air, witness yesterday's melt, is staying here. And as a result of that, these longer periods of time of either cold or heat or rain or even stale air in China leading to more intense problems associated with air pollution. This was a Chinese study done a couple of years ago. It is something that is increasingly of concern, not just in the Arctic, not just in the United States, but globally. Another way in which less ice in the Arctic and a warmer Arctic is of concern to people who don't live here is, of course, sea level rise. And the tricky thing about sea level rise is it's happening faster. The rate of sea level rise is accelerating, and a huge contributor to that is the Greenland ice sheet. So the Greenland ice sheet is actually contributing more to sea level rise now than Antarctica is. That may not always be the case, but it is now. So as you can probably read, a huge amount of what's contributing right now to sea level rise is thermal expansion. And again, as our oceans warm, that will continue to be a problem. And as we lose more and more ice from the Greenland ice sheet, that will continue to be a problem. It's a problem today, but when you look ahead at the projections of how much sea level rise is likely by the end of this century, about a meter is in the conservative range, that's a lot of Miami Beach underwater. But we don't have to wait till then, it's now. So military installations, like the Navy station in Norfolk, Virginia, that's experiencing a lot of sea level rise and constant flooding right now. This is of concern to the military. You probably saw the report this week, the Department of Defense assessment of how many of the military establishments around our nation are at risk from floods, at risk from fires, at risk from drought. This is a serious concern. The military, the Department of Defense, particularly the Navy, but others as well, have really upped their attention level on the extent to which a warmer Arctic is contributing to not only problems like we've just been discussing, but also the potential for more interaction in a region that previously was not considered accessible. So it's like having a brand new ocean. And what does that mean to humans? Well, of course, it means economic opportunity. So shipping and fishing and mining and oil and gas and tourism are now very hot topics globally in terms of things that, well, how about the Arctic? And of course, as we also know, the demand for resources and the whole notion of let's go find something that hasn't been found before. It's always been part of the human idea that there's always another frontier, and now it's the Arctic. So the global attention and the accessibility are combining to really create an energy level that we have never seen before about international attention to this region. We hear a lot about shipping, and there's a lot that can be said about how much of that is hype and how much of that is reality. But let's start with the basics. There are two routes, the Northern Sea Route above Russia, the Northwest Passage above Canada. And the Northern Sea Route right now is the route that is getting more of the traffic between the two. And that's largely because Russia is actively promoting the Northern Sea Route and because Russia has natural resources in the north that they want to get to market. So the promotion is really, well, the Northeast Passage or the Northern Sea Route is shorter. So if it's shorter, that must mean that it would be a better route than the Suez Canal. That is the pitch. But from an Alaska perspective, Look at this choke point. The Bering Strait, only 50 miles across between Alaska and Russia. Regardless of whether you're talking about the Northern Sea Route or the Northwest Passage, is in our backyard. And it's a place where a risk unquestionably exists, not only from the standpoint of relations with Russia, from the standpoint of possible disasters, oil spills, et cetera, but also because the Bering Strait is a marine mammal migration route of considerable importance. And as we know, the marine mammals of the North, using that Bering Strait, is possibly in conflict with a lot more shipping going through the Bering Strait. So it's definitely a concern. We've already seen, for the first time in history, a container ship using the Northern Sea Route going across Russia. And although I don't expect there are going to be a lot of those in the near future, there are a lot more LNG tankers because, of course, of Russia's oil and gas. Tourism has also expanded in the north pretty dramatically, particularly in Svalbard and Norway and Greenland, but also all the way to the North Pole. I had the opportunity to go to the North Pole in the summer of 2017 on a Russian nuclear icebreaker, which at the time was the largest and most powerful icebreaker in the world. Subsequent to that, Russia has built and now put in the water two that are larger and more powerful. But it was quite an experience, particularly being able to go up in a hot air balloon on the north. You know, I mean, you get the feel, right? This is exciting. So there's going to be a lot more tourism because people want adventure. So let's talk about oil and gas. This is one of the other things that, of course, has really attracted a lot of attention in the media and a lot of attention by people who are really on both sides of this question. Yes, there should be development in the north and the oil is there, so let's do it. And people who feel strongly that this is one of the riskier places to do oil and gas development and it shouldn't ever be done there. There are lots of opinions about it, but the reason it's a topic is because USGS says that there's a lot of oil and gas left in the Arctic, and so that attracts attention. Whether or not to drill, whether or not to balance the risk and the revenues and how to do that, obviously depends upon your assessment of whether you have the equipment, the expertise, the knowledge, and the ability to do it safely. I would just note that the countries of the North come down on all sides of that. So Canada has said no. We're not going to do more oil and gas development in the Arctic. Norway, on the other hand, has said, yes, we think we can do it safely, and they are expanding their leasing in the Barents Sea. The US, we go back and forth, don't we? We have said, no, we don't want to do oil development in the north, and then we say yes, and then we say no, and now we're back to yes again. So, you know, stay tuned. And the Russians are bullish on oil and gas development, particularly the Yamal Peninsula, where they have so much resource. This chart sort of explains why. An awfully lot of the discovered oil and gas fields in the north are in Russian territory. And 95% of Russian natural gas reserves are in the Arctic. So of course, it's not surprising that Russia sees this as a very important part of their economy and a very important part of their future, particularly the LNG projects on the Yamal Peninsula. And I might note that the partnership between China and Russia in developing these natural gas reserves, we're already seeing it. So China is using some of their Silk Road Fund, which they now have a Polar Silk Road Fund, to support this new shipping partnership with China and Russia, to be able to take LNG to Asia and to Europe. So let's talk about China for a moment. China has declared itself a near Arctic state. I'm not exactly sure what that means. But they have adopted a policy statement. They have an Arctic policy. And I might just note the one part sentence there, part of their goals. to understand, protect, develop, and participate in the governance of the Arctic. So, what is the Chinese interest in the Arctic? Obviously, in part, it's the natural resources that are in the Arctic. Witness the partnership that I was just talking about with Russia in terms of LNG. I think it's also because China recognizes that as this new region emerges, and some would say it has already emerged, that it is a place where there's a lot of opportunity that has not yet been fully appreciated. And so they have built now, they have their second icebreaker. The first one, the Snow Dragon, was in the Arctic in 2017 and 2018. The new one, the Snow Dragon 2, will be up in the Arctic soon. So they're doing a lot of research. They're trying to understand the Arctic. They are participating in international conferences. And they are reaching interesting partnerships, not just with Russia, but with Norway and with Iceland and with Greenland in terms of research partnerships. And I think ultimately, in their minds, the opportunity to do business. So let's go back to Russia, because Russia is really the big kahuna here. I think it's very important to understand why statements like this by Vladimir Putin make sense from a Russian perspective. This map demonstrates how much of the Arctic is Russian territory. And sometimes we forget that. As a matter of fact, as Alaskans, sometimes we think Alaska is a pretty big place in the Arctic. We are a big state. But when you look at the Arctic and realize how much of Russian coastline, how much of their resources, how much of their population actually lives in the north, I don't think it's terribly surprising, frankly, that Russia is investing in the north. However, having said that, yes, we understand they're investing in the Northern Sea Route in terms of ports and a whole lot of infrastructure. But the additional investment in their military in the north has raised a lot of questions and some concerns. And we have certainly seen a buildup in the north. This slide that was done by Senator Dan Sullivan's office kind of highlights some of the Russian military buildup in the Arctic that is of concern, particularly as they have also been doing exercises in the north. But exactly what is the motive? Is the motive to protect their coastline? Is the motive to make sure that their LNG tankers get safely? Is it to generate more business for the Northern Sea Route? Because they, of course, charge a fee for icebreaker escorts. Is it positioning in terms of global power relationships? I mean, there are a lot of questions that there aren't really good answers to. But I would say that their near neighbors get nervous. Sweden has reinstituted mandatory military conscription, for example. And there are concerns. I think that's partially why the Trident Juncture, NATO's biggest exercise in decades, which was held last fall in Norway with 31 nations participating, 50,000 people participated. All of our military, led by the Navy, participated. It was a NATO exercise in Norway. Matter of fact, when I was in Norway last week, there were still 650 Marines in Norway training, trying to test equipment, trying to work together across borders in a way that sends the signal that NATO and other nations are prepared, if needed, to do work in the Arctic. This is a picture of a conference, actually it was a workshop in DC 2 weeks ago that I was able to attend at the National Defense University. It was basically representatives from all of our branches of the military really focused on this question: what are the security concerns in the Arctic? What are our national security issues? What are our international relation issues? What is our preparedness, our readiness, our ability, if needed, to actually do anything in the Arctic? That is in addition to what we are now seeing in terms of the buildup of military assets in Alaska. This is a pretty long list, and I'm not going to read it to you, but if you look at how many fifth generation fighter jets are going to be in Alaska, if you look at the amount of money that is rolling into military construction in Alaska, it's pretty impressive. And again, how much of this is building up our military capacity vis-a-vis North Korea, Russia? Who knows? All I know is that if you put together a number of pieces of the puzzle, like the increased attention being paid by the Department of Defense in terms of security issues in the North, and you look at the investment that is being made now in Alaska, you can begin to see that it's not just Russia, it's not just NATO, it's not just Sweden, it's not just Norway, it's all of us, even though the Arctic has been a place of great cooperation. There is competition, and there is the feeling that you don't know what's coming next, and maybe we need to prepare. Well, in one way, we are not preparing, and that is in the icebreaker arena. And this is a topic for many Alaskans that you've heard a lot. But, you know, Russia has a lot of icebreakers. Finland, a country of 5 million people, has, you know, they have more icebreakers than the U.S. does. And it's not just how many do you have. You know, it's what kind of condition are they in? So we used to have two heavy icebreakers, Polar Star and Polar Sea. The Polar Sea is now just being used for parts to keep the Polar Star running. That ship primarily services Antarctica. And we have the Healy, which is a medium icebreaker, which is basically the workhorse for the Arctic. These ships are decades old and should have been replaced quite a long time ago. We also have the Sikuliak, by the way, which is an ice-strengthened research vessel which is based in Seward, which is great for research, but it's not an icebreaker. And we need our icebreakers. We need our icebreakers for search and rescue, for military response if needed, for research, for all of those reasons. So it is one space where I think we all need to continue to advocate a replacement and addition to our icebreakers. So all right, I've been talking about conflict, military buildup, Russia, China. I want to transition to something that might make you feel better before you leave tonight, and that is how much cooperation there is in the Arctic. And there is a lot of cooperation, and there's been a lot of cooperation actually for a very long time. This is just a short list of some of the things that illustrate how well the Arctic Eight have really gotten along for a very long period of time. The Arctic Council's been around for over 22 years. And it is really a place where the Arctic nations have found common ground on not only environmental protection, but also sustainable development. And these reports that have been written, the research that's been done, the recommendations that have been offered, the way in which it has really created a bonding in the Arctic has been a very good thing. And of course, in addition to the member countries, the permanent participants representing the indigenous people of the North and the observers, both observer nations and observer organizations, have really helped build the strength and capacity of the Arctic Council. And I think, unlike many international organizations, the indigenous people of the North have really had a very active and meaningful place in terms of participating in all of the working groups, the task forces, and the recommendations. Several agreements have come out of the Arctic Council process: search and rescue, oil spill response, international cooperation of research. All of those things, again, are no-brainers in terms of what you want the countries in a region to be able to do together, work together, and plan together. And that gave rise to something that is really important. Our Coast Guards cooperate with each other, and they actually do drills together, which again is pretty important if you're talking about a growth in tourism or even oil and gas and having to respond to a spill. The Polar Code, which was adopted by the International Maritime Organization, sets higher standards for ships that are operating in the Arctic. Again, that just became effective in 2017. It is a huge step forward, and it, again, came out of a lot of support from the Arctic Council and the nations that have said, you know, we want to reduce risk. We want to work together. If we're going to use this space, we have to do it wisely. And this one is really an amazing story. The new fisheries agreement that not only the Arctic nations have agreed to, but in addition to that, South Korea, China, Japan, and the EU have agreed that they will not fish in the central Arctic Ocean for 16 years. Because we don't know enough about what's there to be able to sustainably manage a fishery. This is a beautiful example, a textbook case of what is called the precautionary principle, where you put in place a conservation measure before there's a disaster instead of after it. This is pretty amazing, actually. Not a lot of examples that one can point to in this day and age. This is something that, again, really came out of the kind of cooperation and sense of we're in this together as a result of the work of the Arctic Council over the years. International scientific cooperation for some people seems like, well, what, is that really that important? Yes, it is, because it's really important that countries work together to understand what's happening in the Arctic and what kind of things like the fisheries agreement need to be done to protect this very vulnerable and valuable place. It's a huge area, and no one country can begin to afford or have the ability to do the research that's necessary in the region alone. So this kind of international cooperation is really important. There have been two science ministerials. I've been at both of them as a delegate for the US. And I would just say that we've really made progress. The last one was in Berlin in October, and there were 25 nations of the world committing to the not only the resources, but joint projects that really help us improve our understanding of the Arctic. So I'm almost done. The Arctic Research Commission, which I chair, I would just note that the report that we do, the goals and objectives, there's about to be a new one in about a month. But if you're interested in the old one, there's a thumb drive, free thumb drives with the report available at the front desk if you want to pick one up on your way out. And if you want to stay abreast of what's going on in the Arctic, sign up for the daily update. It's an electronic newsletter, which we do every day, except, of course, during the government shutdown, we were dark. But if you go to arctic.gov, you can sign up and stay in touch with what's going on in the Arctic. Okay, so are you ready for the answers to the quiz? Get your quiz out. Yes, get your quiz out. And everybody can check their own. Let's see what the answers are. I don't know if you can read this. Okay. Number one, yes, true. Temperatures exceeded all previous records. Number two, true. Also, we've lost a lot of the ice. We've talked about that already. Number three, yes, Russia has 50 major icebreakers. Another 9 under construction. So that is true. Number four, yes, Russia's northern sea route is definitely busier than the Canadian Northwest Passage. Still not big numbers, but definitely on the increase. Whoops, past that one. Number five, the Titanic question. That sometimes confuses people. They think, well, you know, if the ice is going away, maybe there are fewer icebergs. Actually, no, just the opposite. It's false. There are many more icebergs. And that, of course, is largely the contribution of the Greenland ice sheet, but other glaciers as well. Number six, global sea level rise, false. Unquestionably, Greenland is producing about twice as much as Antarctica right now. Seven, true. Yes, looking at somewhere between 2 and 5 feet of sea level rise in the DC area by the end of the century. Eight, true. Yes, unfortunately, many villages in Alaska are at risk, because of coastal erosion, because of storm damage, because of thawing permafrost. And as you know, a number of our communities, like Kivalina and Shishmaref and Newtok, are already in the process, some degree in the process of moving. Number nine is also true. Yes, unfortunately, anthrax seems to have just come from the thawing permafrost. 10, true. Also, mercury is entering the Arctic in a variety of ways. 11, false. Unfortunately, herd populations of caribou and wild reindeer have decreased by about 50% in the last two decades, not increased. 12, yes, this is another slightly tricky one. It's false because the numbers weren't quite right. The numbers in your quiz and the real numbers are a little different, so I apologize ahead of time. That was a little bit of a fake question. 13, true. Billy Mitchell, his assessment of how strategic the Arctic is something that many people in the military talk about today as well. 14, true. 60% of the Arctic land area is Russian. 15 is false. Why is that false? Because as we talked about, it's not only Russia that is building up its military capacity in the north. Others are as well, including the US. 16 is true. 17 is false. Why is it false? Because the US Senate has never ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty. Everybody else pretty much under the sun has, but not the US, which means that it would be very difficult for us to prove up and claim and obtain our extended continental shelf claims. And 18, last but not least, is false. Why is that false? Because the countries that have agreed to not fish in the central Arctic Ocean are not just the Arctic nations, but of course China, Korea, Japan, Iceland, and the European Union as well. So, how did you all do? Are there any winners, as in you got them all right? Raise your hand if you got them all right. Okay, here's one. Yay, good job. Anybody else? Okay, so. There you go. It's a don't use plastic, always refill a water bottle kind of message. Yes. Okay. All right. So we have time for questions. There is someone out there with a microphone who will run the mic to you, and then please ask your question. Wow. Do you have another hour? big question. Let me just take a slice of it. What should Alaska be doing right now with regard to climate change that is consistent with our economy doing well? And I think the no-brainer on that is helping communities prepare for the change that is coming. The adaptation, the resilience, the ability of communities, whether it's Anchorage or Kivalina, to anticipate what the change is going to look like there in their community and to prepare for it is something that I think is essential. Actually, it's not only in Alaska. I think it's all coastal communities particularly. But we sort of started doing that under the last administration. There was the Climate Action Leadership Team that the previous governor appointed and basically focused on not only what should we be doing about renewable energy? What should we be doing about creating a green economy? What should we be doing about helping communities prepare for the change ahead? I think there's a lot of work to be done in that space that is not only intended to reduce risk in the future, reduce costs that will be there if we do nothing at all, but that can also create jobs, frankly, associated with that kind of adaptation and preparing for the future and creating new kinds of jobs. So that's a shorter version of a much longer discussion that we could have about not only the economy, but how Actually, climate, even though it is, yes, it is a huge problem, and it is something that the sooner we face and deal with, the better off we'll be, it also has the potential for creating jobs and opportunities here in Alaska and in the lower 48. Other questions?
Hi, I'm Ryan Bacon with Alaska Salmon Fertilizer. Earlier, you briefly mentioned the fiscal impact of the fisheries. And one thing I was wondering about, if you were familiar enough with that model, the hypothesis that a lot of fishermen, specifically the drifters off the Kenai, had on the temperature of the water levels and the impact of that with fish diving underneath their nets, if you might have any familiarity with that.
So this week in Anchorage, the Alaska Marine Science Symposium has been going on every day, all day, at the Captain Cook. And it has been one science presentation after another, kind of rapid fire, about the changes in the Bering Sea, the Chukchi, the Beaufort, the extent to which the water temperatures, the extent to which salinity changes, the extent to which all these things are happening very quickly and in surprising ways. And I would just say that the combination of changes that are happening in salinity, in water temperature, in currents, in the entire ecosystem of the waters around Alaska, make it very difficult to say anything clean cut about why one thing happens and thus something else is the result, if you know what I mean. The complexity now of what is happening in terms of the rapid rate of change that is being experienced, particularly in the north, leaves a lot of work to be done by the science community, but also I would say, this is not necessarily true for all of the presentations I heard today, but also the sense that what we know today is going to be dramatically changed tomorrow because of the interaction of all of these changes dramatically altering the ecosystems that we used to consider as relatively stable. So for the fishing industry, I think this has really big implications. We know that many species are moving north. We've seen this not just in the Western Arctic, but also in the Eastern Arctic. And so the cod species, Iceland has had a tremendous boom in fisheries over the last 2 or 3 years, cod and mackerel, because of the northern movement of fish. So how to predict this in a way that really helps you, if you're in the fishing industry, make decisions about what species you're targeting or what gear you're going to use, or even whether or not you will be able to commercial fish the way you've always commercial fished 5 or 10 years from now. There is so much uncertainty, I guess is what I'm trying to say. The presentations from the Marine Science Symposium are available online for those of you who really want to take a deeper dive in some of the heavy science. I would recommend that you go there. And the other place I'd recommend is going to AOOS, the Arctic Ocean Observing System that Molly McCammon is the head of. They have a lot of information on their website about ocean acidification, about water temperature data and salinity data, and some of the preliminary results in terms of the improved understanding about how these changes might affect fisheries. One more question. You've been a really polite audience. You are so quiet. You know, I would just have to say my experience over the years of speaking at lunch events versus evening events, a long time ago, I promised myself I would never give serious lectures when there was beer and wine involved. You know, only kind of light topics or, you know, just really short. I have blown through those promises I made to myself tonight. But you've all been so attentive. I really appreciate it. Okay, one more question. Yes, ma'am.
Oh,
whoever's got the mic. Sorry.
Sorry. Fran, thank you for the presentation. It was wonderful. It's a complex area, and you presented a lot of different pieces of what's going on in the Arctic. My question relates to Personally, I think it's the most interesting geopolitical area in the world. And you questioned the motivations of the Russian Federation as to what their motivation is. One of the things that I understand is that the Russians have also developed a nuclear underwater oil tanker for extracting oil from under the sea ice at the Arctic. If you read the literature, the foreign policy literature on the motivations of the Russian Federation, it seems fairly clear that the Russians view the Arctic as their new Weltraum and their new resurgence of becoming a world power, which they descended from after the Cold War. So I guess I'm wondering, one of the things that I've also read is that the United States is far behind, not just in icebreakers. We have two, one which is dilapidated, and the Russians have 50. The Russians have militarized the Arctic. We've maybe enhanced our military capabilities for air capacity here. But I'm wondering how you would grade the current administration and its focus on the Arctic region and the importance to the United States, particularly given the fact that Senator Murkowski has lobbied heavily for the development of a new icebreaker, which is a bargaining chip in the current debate over building border security in the South. So how would you grade the current administration and its focus on the Arctic region, and are they putting enough importance?
Is this a true-false, or? Only kidding. So let me answer that by doing a slight comparison. So during the previous administration, let's just kind of look at a few of the things that indicated a focus on the Arctic. So in 2013, the U.S. adopted its very first Arctic strategy. In 2014, the U.S. adopted a strategic plan to basically move that strategy forward. In 2015, the administration created the Arctic Executive Steering Committee, which was a way of coordinating all of the cabinet officials that had any jurisdiction in the Arctic to talk to each other, meet quarterly, and do deliverables together. In 2016, I could go on. You get the picture here. There was an increasing attention paid and mechanisms to really focus the power and energy and authorities, not much money, but at least attention on the Arctic as a strategic region. And the strategy talked about national security, international cooperation, and stewardship of the Arctic resources. Those were the three big planks associated with that strategy. That strategy still technically exists. It has not been, you know, erased somehow. It's still there. But for the last 2 years, there has not really been any substantial progress that one can see on moving any of that agenda forward. The exception to what I've just said is in some agencies, like the Coast Guard, like the Navy, where there are efforts underway to at least try to use whatever resources they do have to make some progress. So, you know, the Coast Guard did a study about icebreakers and what it would take. They moved that forward. They worked with the Navy. The Navy actually helped them with that study. And there was money in the budget. You know, that was progress. But you're right, the money that was in the budget is now being put into the wall instead of the icebreaker category, right? So kind of a tiny step forward, but then maybe a step back at the same time. But this meeting that I went to 2 weeks ago in DC with really high level representation from the Department of Defense and all of the branches of the military, plus Alaska National Guard and the Coast Guard, talking about the strategic importance of the Arctic, trying to discuss at a more detailed level what kind of exercises are required, what kind of new cooperation with our partners in the North are necessary. I mean, I think the Department of Defense gets it, and I think our military gets it. I think there has been a shortage of commitment of funding, and you're absolutely right. I mean, our congressional delegation has begged for icebreakers for a long time. As a matter of fact, for a long time, our congressional delegation pushed pretty hard to try to get the Law of the Sea Treaty ratified. You know, Senator Stevens worked hard on that. But it's just really hard to get the attention of people in the lower 48. I mean, I don't want to be overly critical here, but other Arctic nations tend to think of themselves as Arctic nations. They have an identity. I mean, Canada thinks of itself as an Arctic nation. Russia certainly does. Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland, they think of themselves as an Arctic nation. You know, if you go have coffee with some folks in Iowa, I don't think they're going to say, yeah, U.S. is an Arctic nation. You know, it's kind of not really that much part of our identity. And so for a lot of people, and particularly people who are in control of the budget, you know, it doesn't seem like it's that important. And, you know, some people say, well, it's inevitable at some point there will be an incident, and an incident, whatever that is, whether it's military, national security, oil spill, shipping disaster, tourist boat, you know, going down, whatever, that maybe there will be an incident that makes the U.S. sort of stand up and say, once again, we are an Arctic nation and we have to invest in the region. But why do we have to wait for bad things to happen? You know, I mean, this is so clear to people, I think, who spend just a moment thinking about it, that getting ahead of this and preparing and having the the assets needed, assets like icebreakers, but not just icebreakers, telecommunications, assets like doing the necessary work to bring the Arctic waters up to international shipping or navigational standards. I mean, only 10% of the Arctic has been charted to international navigational standards. I mean, that's an accident waiting to happen. So there are a lot of things that we need to do and we should do, and if we, you know, had the will, we would have done already, I guess. So I wish I had a really good ask of you all in terms of helping to make this happen. About the best ask I can come up with is, as you are curious about this and as you learn more, as you think more, as you talk to your friends and neighbors, and particularly as you talk to people in powerful places, whether that's in the private sector or the public sector, when you talk to people in the lower 48, your friends, your relatives, people you used to work with who have, you know, who live outside, talk to them about the Arctic. Try to help them understand that this valuable, vulnerable region, which is critical to the future of not only the U.S., but the world, is a place that they need to pay more attention to and invest in. So with that, I will say thank you all very much for coming. Good night. Thank you. Yeah, and I will.
With that, I want to thank Ms. Fran Ulmer for speaking to us today and present her with this wonderful insulated tote. Maybe I'll just keep it. While she's coming back out, I want to thank everyone for coming and encourage you to come tomorrow. We have some seats available. We'll be right back here at noon where we'll be featuring Dr. Bill Von Hippel. We have information on the tables. There you are. Thank you very much for speaking to us, and we have a little gift for you. It's an insulated tote to keep things that you want warm, warm, and things you want cold, cold, and some travel things, so when you're traveling around the world, if it's Germany or Norway or Harvard, you can share a little bit of Alaska and your message about the Arctic. Thank you very much. And if you'd like to recycle your tags, please leave them at the door on your way out, and we hope to see you again soon.